Today on CityCast Chicago, campus protests continue at universities across the city, temporary casinos' underwhelming balance sheets, and happy National Teacher Day. Here to talk about it all, executive producer Simone Alisea. It's Tuesday, May 7th. I'm Jacoby Cochran, and this is What Chicago's Talking About. Good morning, Simone. How you feeling?
Good morning, Jacoby. I'm all right. How are you?
I'm doing good. I've been singing, "They not like us, they not like us, they not like us," for like the last 48 hours. So
I think you and half the internet.
So overall, I'm doing okay. It seems like the number one song in America right now, so I'm not alone. But as with most of our Tuesday conversations, we got some stories to break down that picked up over the weekend. And we have to start with the encampments that have been set up at universities across the city, places like DePaul, UChicago, up at Northwestern, and even at the School of the Art Institute over the weekend. But Simone, we started to see our first clashes with counter protests with police. What took place over the weekend?
Yeah, so at the School of the Art Institute, I think let's start there since that was a spot where we saw dozens of arrests over the weekend. So that camp started to get set up on Saturday on the North Garden of the Art Institute, which is right downtown. It's right, you know, right by the museum, Michigan and Monroe area.
Yep.
And students started setting up an encampment there, and police went in within hours of it being with it popping up. Student organizers had been in discussions with university administrators about, you know, their different demands, which mirror demands that we've seen at these protests across the city for these schools to divest from, stop investments with companies that are tied to Israel. Also, lots of demands around bringing Palestinian students to campus or providing some kind of avenue to, you know, bring Palestinian scholars to these institutions.
Because reports say about pretty much all of the universities in Gaza have sustained damage or been decimated.
Exactly.
Over these 6 months,
Among other things as well. But mm-hmm. I think the biggest thing is these investment issues, right?
Of
to what degree are these schools supporting companies that are supporting war in Gaza, right? That are mm-hmm. a part of that. And from the reports over the weekend, it sounds like talks between organizers and the university broke down, and administrators called in CPD, and eventually 68 protesters were arrested. Organizers reported that most of those students had been released by Sunday, but it was the first time we had really seen in Chicago a case of mass arrests at any of these demonstrations. And we saw over the weekend tensions rise at these other campuses that you mentioned as well. At DePaul, police had a larger presence, but a bigger issue there was that DePaul also saw a lot of counter protesters, and there was sort of a holding the line, so to speak, between them.
There was a video going around of one of the campus protesters being stricken by an Israeli flag, like being struck by one of the counter protesters. And, you know, earlier in my sort of setup, I said this is the first time we saw clashes, but more times than not, at least in the videos I've seen, there isn't really a clash happening. Largely, campus protesters are sort of locked there in chains, sort of continuing their demands, continuing their calls, their chants. And like what we saw at SAIC was police push through those and started arresting people. And when you see in pictures of like 3-4 police officers to a student, it starts to trigger you, as you've seen time and time again over the last few years, that when largely nonviolent protests are happening, that at a certain point, police sort of step in, and that escalation almost always is you know, 10 times worse than sort of what we saw taking on campus prior.
Well, and I think it's interesting too, if we think about all of these universities occupy kind of different spaces in the city, right? Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Northwestern, which that encampment ended last week. There were sort of successful negotiations between the administration and protesters, as successful in the sense that, you know, the encampment was disassembled and university operations went on as normal. So, you know, they're reviving a committee to look into some of these investment concerns.
But the minute something set up downtown that wasn't sort of like the four walls of a university, sort of like keeping it within a campus pocket, because SAIC, like the Art Institute, just sort of sits on Michigan. You can't really discern it as a school per se.
No, I think probably most certainly like tourists, for example, probably don't even register that is a school at all, right? It's the Art Institute. Yep. It is, you know, a major draw in the middle of the city, you know, right next to Millennium Park. It is the sort of context of that encampment is really, really different than, say, suburban Evanston out on a university campus. And similarly, right, and then I think you have a spot like DePaul, which is, you know, in the middle of a neighborhood. And then you have University of Chicago, where as of Monday, the encampment has continued there. And there has been, I would say, from what I have read of the reporting, it sounds like the situation there is more tense.
Any moment it feels like encampments could be torn down, that if people are still there, that they could be arrested. We saw in early protests at UChicago that faculty members and students were arrested and charged with criminal offenses. And so the faculty, the members of the encampment at UChicago, they're constantly sitting there wondering, when is the shoe going to drop? And, you know, I got emails Sunday night that said protesters were preparing for a large police presence to intervene. And so, yeah, like when you start talking about UChicago, when you start talking about DePaul, as you mentioned, that sit inside of neighborhoods and have, in some cases, you know, especially UChicago, contentious relationships with the neighborhood.
Right.
It has everyone sitting on pins and needles there.
Yeah. So we'll see how this unfolds. I mean, we are, you know, it's May now. You know, I know some of these schools are on the quarter system, so their graduations are a little later, right? I think you're hearing across the country about commencements being canceled and things like that. Mm-hmm. We haven't quite seen anything like that around Chicago just yet, but we will see.
One story from my perspective that seems to have lost steam over the first 5 or so months of the year is what the hell is going on with the temporary casino at Medina Temple. Last year, we talked a whole lot about this process. And so, like, a quick recap to people, right? Chicago has a temporary casino in lieu of a permanent casino that is supposed to start construction in July, be finished and opened at least the first phase in 2026. At the former Chicago Tribune site. Now, throughout this entire process, we have been told that the temporary casino is supposed to be bringing in a certain amount of money every month, which is supposed to build confidence as we move towards a more permanent casino. Simone, I need you to come in here. The numbers aren't matching up with the initial figures we heard from the Lori Lightfoot administration and not from what we've heard from officials in and outside the Bally's organization since this temporary casino opened.
Right. As we recall, when the former mayor was pushing this through the city council quite aggressively, the whole point was that this is going to be a big moneymaker for Chicago, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to get a lot of tax revenue out of this, even during this temporary phase. And Block Club Chicago reported this week from an earnings call that is just not happening at the levels that were projected. First of all, the temporary casino opened later than expected. It didn't open until September of 2023. And there were projected to be tax revenue at around $12.8 million by the end of 2023. The casino only brought in $3.1 million. You're like, okay, you open late, it's early days, like, That's you know, you're still talking about like 1/4 of what you were trying to do, but mm-hmm. let's see what can happen. And now in the first few months of 2024, we're not seeing it grow that much more. The idea was that, you know, it would be bringing in roughly $3 million a month. We're actually looking at about $3 million in the first part of 2024 over the last few months. So they are really behind projections here. And I think it is, you know, there's a lot going on at Bally's.
Right, right. The company is much bigger than Chicago, right?
This is the thing, is there's a lot going on at Bally's on the back end here. You have the chair who's trying to take the company private, who's trying to essentially buy out the company and take it private. Sort of late last year, they had cut positions across the country. Executives had said they were open to selling their Vegas casino. And so, you know, there's a lot going on with Bally's, the company, that is potentially contributing to some of the lackluster performance that we've seen here in Chicago. You know, executives say that they're going to up marketing. They're going to try to offer more perks. You know, they've got concierge deals with different hotels around the area.
They kind of been in financial straits for a while between having to sell off licensing. Now they have to consider selling off the land that the casino, the former Tropicana in Vegas, set on to pay for the Chicago deal. I mean, we all were like, you know, there's only so many casino companies. The pitch was one that the mayor said was better than the others. But I don't know. It doesn't feel as if the scrutiny of Bally's as a company, you know, was as strong during those mock-up periods.
Well, and now, of course, you also have issues that are sort of forthcoming with the permanent casino, right? They have to change plan. They were going to build a hotel, right, to go along with the casino, and they have to change plans for where that hotel is going to go because there were issues with, like, water lines, which is sort of I don't work in design. I don't work in planning. I don't make buildings for a living. But I feel like where the water is kind of a big deal when you're designing a multi-million dollar entertainment hub. I don't know.
I feel like people who draw these mock-ups, and I've always saw this this clash online of like, they'll be like, this is the architect's dream. And then the engineers are just like, I hate you, bro, because you get to just draw this thing. And now we get to have to figure it out. And it feels like that's what's happening here. Like, they put these mock-ups out and then some engineers got to it and were like, this don't even make sense, bro. Like, this isn't even possible. We're not just changing because we're trying to make concessions for the neighborhood and for the city. Bro, you see there's a river right there? What are you doing? That doesn't even make sense. And so, yeah, some people, like Chicago Sun-Times architect critic Lee Bay, believes that this is just the writing on the wall for continued delays. And ultimately what he believes is the abandonment of this project. He says that it will either sort of be built at a far less scale or won't even be built at all at the Chicago Tribune site. And, you know, that I imagine it has to be concerning for folks about to hop on a Bally's call on May 16th.
Yeah, I mean, and we'll have to see, right? There's still so much that's up in the air. Like, you know, really anything could happen. I have to say, though, on paper, it does seem like a no-brainer, given how well gambling is doing across Illinois as a general industry, right? You have J.B. Pritzker in Springfield right now trying to eke out more tax dollars from all these sports books that have opened up, who are bringing in just like year over year. You know, they brought in $1 billion last year, you know.
I mean, and it's the second most visited casino in Illinois, according to
the state officials.
And it's only been around since the end of last year. And, you know, if we're to take all of these criticisms at face value, to be the second most visited casino and you're not doing well at marketing, all of your restaurants are not in, you're not pulling people from across the city in, the bar just seems to be, you know, very low and easy to jump over, which I imagine means they're going to just be doing better as the year goes on.
Or that the revenue promises were mismatched to begin with, right? Or that what was promised to come in was too high, right? That, or yeah, like, right, you know what I mean? Like, second most visited in the state, that's nothing to sneeze at, but perhaps still over projected. You know, I will also be interested to see, there is some other legislation in Springfield to legalize, you know, video slots, video gambling throughout the city of Chicago. And, you know, there has been some pushback from the casino on that of like,
we're trying to be the only player in town. Like that's what they want.
It's going to make that even harder. And then you have just an other gambling news, right? You have Dave and Buster's who's trying to
let people
bet
on the arcade.
Arcade games. It's like it's supposed to be like peer-to-peer betting, essentially. It's like, but still, that, and you do have
that feels like gambling grooming.
That, yeah, and you do have some state lawmakers in Illinois who are like, please. There's the, you know, one of state lawmaker was like, the Dave and Buster's in my district is in a mall. Like, no, thank you. Like, I really don't want this to be there. But it's interesting, you know. It is like. It's a huge market, and there's a lot of money to be made there.
I gotta ask, is anybody in your circle, have they gone or are they going?
To the casino?
Yeah.
You know I play D&D every week, right? No. So, no,
they're not. I mean, and I have gamblers in my circle, but it's still largely online sports betting. It's not a lot of people going to play or making time to go play poker or go play slots or go play roulette. People want to gamble on the things they're already semi-invested in, whether it's their local sports teams or the sports they enjoy in general. And I don't know, it just feels like my friends are not having conversations about like poker strategy or like the best way to play roulette. There's something built into we're also enjoying the game together, or we're also in a fantasy football league together, or the group chat is already talking about the playoffs. So, oh, we might as well get these lays in.
It is chatty, right? I do think sports gambling is very chatty, right? And you can talk about here's why I did this and here's why I went that way.
Every time I go to I've gone to the Medina Temple Casino twice, and it just feels so isolated. It feels that one or two people or three people are there together, but some of them go to different tables. And when you're sitting there, you just kind of locked in on your own thing. The blackjack table I was sitting at, like the dealer, like they weren't really friendly or anything. They didn't like make me feel like I needed to be there longer, that I was in the in group, that I was at a party or a celebration. It just felt like, all right, cool. You finna sit down. All right, let's play. And that didn't leave me feeling like, oh, this is a place to go for a vibe.
And you can imagine in a place like River North, like, you've got plenty of other options, right? If you're not feeling the vibe, like there's six other clubs within walking distance. There's a rooftop over here. There's a club over here. I can go dance over here. I can get a world-class meal over here. You know what I mean? Like it's got to be pretty competitive for night traffic. Jacoby, you mentioned yesterday that it's Teacher Appreciation Week, and today is actually National Teacher Day. And since I didn't go to school here in Chicago, I thought it would be great if we brought in producer Michelle Navarro to shout out some Chicago teachers who made a difference for you guys. Hey, Michelle, welcome to the mic.
Hey, Simone.
Michelle, who is a teacher that you want to show some love to today?
So I feel like I was really lucky because in high school, I felt that I had a couple of teachers who were just really on my side. And that's Mr. Nemec, Mr. DiAgostino, and this is a counselor, but he was damn near a teacher, Rigo Padilla Perez, who unfortunately passed away last year to cancer. Mr. Nemec and Mr. DiAgostino is my English teacher, and Mr. Nemec was my history teacher. Mr. Nemec is someone who is special to me because he was the first person to ever call me a writer. And not only that, but a good one. And I was 15 years old, and I knew writing was something that I really loved to do, but I never felt, I guess, empowered to actually identify myself as such. And, you know, it wasn't only that he told me that personally, but he told that to me in front of my whole class and even to my sister at a parent-teacher conference. And so, you know, to have someone that I really respected say that meant a lot to 15-year-old me. And Mr. DiAgostino, he put me on to journalism. I definitely would not be here on the mic if it wasn't for him. He pushed me to get into newspaper, and he recommended me to this journalism program that was specifically for high school students at DePaul. And that program definitely changed, you know, the way that I viewed journalism and the way that what I wanted to study when I got to college and beyond. He would let me borrow his personal copies of his favorite books and was always really interested in what I had to say. And so, you know, because I respected both these teachers a lot, just having two people who really believed in me more than I believed in myself at the time was incredibly meaningful. And my counselor my counselor, Rigo Padilla, he is someone that like would check me when he knew I wasn't being myself. And I just feel like he always reminded me of who I was, even when I couldn't really remember. He dedicated his life to social justice. He was like a founding member of the Illinois Dream Fund. He was a dreamer himself, and he advocated for students in my community, specifically for undocumented students. And I think he made such an impact. The community really felt his loss last year. Those were three people that I really hold close to and I will forever be grateful for.
That is really, really lovely, Michelle. I think it's so important when you have someone in your life who like identifies you as something other than, you know, a student, a daughter, a kid, right? As that you're already doing the work and recognizing that you're already doing the work. Jacoby, is there a teacher you want to shout out during this National Teacher Day?
Yes. I had a teacher in mind, and then I was listening to Michelle, and it made me think about two people who were in my elementary school, Santa Clarita, who probably didn't get as much praise. And it's because they were support staff. One was Miss Clay, who was the secretary at our school the entire time I was there. And one story in particular reminds me of how much I always loved and adored Miss Clay. And it goes all the way back to the first grade. And I have this scar on my right arm. It's a pretty big scar. It runs from my wrist down to the middle of my forearm. And when I was in the first grade, I got to school and I tripped on the steps and I had a glass Mystic bottle and the glass shattered and a piece of glass went from my wrist all the way down to the middle of my forearm. And where I entered the school was on the opposite end of the building from where the secretary's office was. And so I picked myself up and I put my hand over my arm. And I still remember to this day. And I got up and I walked all the way to the office, sort of like grabbing my arm. And I get to the secretary's office. And I remember getting to the door and I was standing there and I just quickly took my hand off of my arm and put it back on to show Miss Clay that I was bleeding profusely. And she immediately sort of sprung into action and wrapped my arm and sat me there and, you know, didn't remind me of how clumsy I had been even in just those first 2 years at the school. And I remember right before, you know, after everything sort of got bandaged up, she looked at me and she just goes, "Well, I'm glad that was your right arm, but everyone knows you're left-handed." And I just laughed because it meant I had to go back to class and do all of my work. But even as early as kindergarten, first grade, Miss Clay was always there every single day. When I think back to my school, I just didn't think about my teachers. I thought about the lunch staff and Miss Horton, rest in peace. I thought about Miss Clay in the secretary's office. And then the other person I wanted to give love to was someone who passed away a few years ago, which was Miss Hannah, who was my library teacher. But not only was she my library teacher, but she was also my father's library teacher. And every time I think about her, I think this is the person who taught me what a palindrome was, because that's how she always introduced herself, because Hannah spelled both ways, get you Hannah. But beyond that, she's someone who, to this day, I go over to her children's house because I went to school with her grandkids. And so I'm still close with them. I'm with their parents. My mom went to school with one of Miss Hannah's sons, and they're very close to each other. Miss Hannah and Miss Clay were just these two people from kindergarten through eighth grade you could rely on, you could always expect to see, you could always go sit in the secretary's office or sit in the library. These two women were the backbone of that elementary school. And all these years later, I probably remember some of the lessons they taught me before and after school than the ones I learned in the classroom. And so huge shout out to Miss Clay. Huge shout out to Miss Hannah. You know, rest in peace, Miss Hannah. And I'm just so grateful for all the teachers I got at Santa Clarita. It truly was something that I'm still unpacking to this day how important it was in my life.
One thing I really loved about both of your stories is just how integral all of these people were in your communities. Like, it wasn't just where you were in the school building and how they affected you there, but that, you know, those effects rippled out across your networks and everyone you know and the people who the people you're with. And so if you have a teacher that you want to shout out, this is the week to do it. Shoot us a text, 773-780-0246. We want to hear about it.
Now that I have you both here, I have to give another thank you to our executive producer, Simone Alisea. Always appreciate you, my friend.
Thanks, Jacoby.
And Michelle, the person who has been enjoying this KDOT absolute demolishment of the Canadian. It is good to see you back on the mic, my friend.
Good to see you too. Thanks, Jacoby.
Before we let you go, remember the CityCast Chicago ecosystems does not start and stop with the podcast. You can also go check out our website, chicago.citycast.fm. While you're there, you'll see some of the latest headlines, a packed events calendar, and make sure you check out those neighborhood guides. Our newsletter editor, Sydney Madden, works very hard on them. You know how I know? Because I get Hey Chicago every morning in my inbox Monday through Friday. You should subscribe and join the team. Now, something you can only get on the podcast, some good news. I got to give a huge shout out to my friends at the Invisible Institute and City Bureau. Invisible Institute won the Pulitzer Prize for audio reporting for their podcast series, You Didn't See Nothing, hosted by Johan Slakor. And City Bureau and the Invisible Institute won the Pulitzer Prize for local reporting for their joint investigation from Sarah Conway and Trina Reynolds Tyler called Missing in Chicago. We actually did episodes on both, so check the show notes to listen. And again, much love to everybody involved. As always, we appreciate you for listening. We're going to be back bright and early tomorrow talking about one of my favorite things, farmers markets. I'm going to talk to y'all then. Peace.